Thank you all so much for being here. My name is Nathan Wilson. I've had the privilege to help in some part organizing this event. I just gotta say, as a young conservative attorney, to see so many of my colleagues in a room, you know, here, interested in an event like this, is just a huge encouragement. This next panel is gonna be fantastic. I'm gonna get out of the way real quick. I'm just here to introduce the moderator, Chief Justice Newby. Chief Justice Newby is a graduate of the University of North Carolina School of Law. He worked in private practice, served as an assistant U.S. attorney, and then made his way to the bench. He's a renowned historian, a dedicated public servant, and he's a friend and mentor to many in this room. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Chief Justice Paul Newby.
Thank you all. Thanks. Renowned historian is another way to say the guy's really old. Has lived most of the history of the earth. Thank you. I, too, am thrilled to see the turnout today. This is something that many of us have hoped for a very long time. And I hope this will be the first of many of these gatherings. It is an encouragement to have opportunities to network and get to talk with folks that have some similar worldviews. And as Ashley so appropriately pointed out, COVID, if nothing else, showed us our need for community, our need to get together and see folks face to face. So it is just really a delight to be here with you on with a panel on a topic about which I am very passionate. State constitutions in general, our state constitution in specifics. I want to take just one moment of personal privilege and tell you all a little bit about the state of the North Carolina judicial branch. I have now been to 92 of the 100 counties, plus the Cherokee Nation. We have a state that is diverse in every way you can imagine diversity. Not just geographic, from the highest point to the lowest point. Embarrassing story, I did have to Google lowest point in North Carolina, and it comes back, duh, idiot, is where the ocean meets the sand. So anyway, so I've been to both, Mount Mitchell, the ocean. You know, diverse with regard to race, ethnicity, gender, you name it, the 7,000 employees of the judicial branch share one real passion, and that is to uphold our constitutional mandate. There are two in our state constitution that are of specific interest to those of us in the judicial branch, in particular Article 1, Section 1, that says we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all of us are created equal and endowed by our Creator, endowed by God with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. Yes, we plagiarized it from the Declaration of Independence, but, you know, it was hard to improve on that. But wait, we did, because we added to it everybody's entitled to the fruits of their own labor, recognizing the dignity of all work. And as I tell my 7,000 employees of the judicial branch, I think, my personal view is that God has created each of us with different skill sets, gifts, and talents, and calls us to work. And whether it's a custodian in a courthouse, whether it's a deputy assistant clerk, a magistrate, a bailiff, a court coordinator, all these unsung heroes of the courthouse, because of their passion for justice, met our constitutional mandate under Article 1, Section 18 that says the courts shall be open. And justice shall be administered without favor and denial and delay. And I am pleased to report to you that despite all the diversity that we have in our judicial branch, we have a passion for equal justice under the law. And folks, that's a judicial system you can be proud of. I know I am. As we think about our state constitution, Article 1, Section 35 reminds us that a frequent recurrence to fundamental principles is absolutely necessary to preserve the blessings of liberty. That's what we're fixing to do right now. We're going to think about some fundamental principles with regard to our state constitution. Is there a difference between constitutions, state and federal? If so, what would those be? And how do we go about interpreting these foundational documents? You have a renowned panel. Your panel includes my dear friend and one who allowed me to assist in the second edition of his seminal work on the state constitution, Professor John Orth. He is retired from the William Rand Keenan Jr. Professor of Law Emeritus at UNC School of Law after 40 years of service, but continues to teach as an adjunct professor. We are grateful for your continued willingness to do that, Professor Orth. You're an internationally recognized author and historian, one of the leading scholars on the North Carolina Constitution, and probably maybe the smartest guy I know. So I'm glad to have Professor Orth on this panel. Ryan Park. Ryan is the Solicitor General of North Carolina, where he oversees the state civil appellate litigation under Attorney General Josh Stein. He graduated summa cum laude from Harvard Law School. Probably wasn't too easy. Clerked all three levels of the federal judiciary, including for Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and David Souter. He teaches North Carolina constitutional law at the UNC Law School. I hope you use our book. we have Andrew Tripp. Andrew is the Senior Vice President and General Counsel in the Office of Legal Affairs for the University of North Carolina System. Andrew is a graduate of Duke University School of Law. He previously served as a federal law clerk. He then was in private practice for a number of years before he became general counsel and eventually chief of staff to the president pro tem of the General Assembly. Andrew, thanks for joining us as well. Our last panelist is former Chief Justice Stephen Markham of the Michigan Supreme Court. Chief Justice Markham served on the Michigan Supreme Court for over 20 years, including 3 years as the Chief Justice. In addition to his judicial service, Chief Justice Markham has had a remarkable and distinguished legal career, including serving as a U.S. attorney, an assistant attorney general of the United States in the Reagan administration, where he coordinated judicial selection. Certainly, he has served as a professor, a writer, a private practitioner. He's a nationally known scholar when it comes to state constitutions, and he also continues to serve as an adjunct professor of constitutional law at Hillsdale College. Let's greet the panel, please. I love our state constitutional history. To me, one of my favorite stories is that on December the 17th of 1776, we had ready the state constitution for its adoption. But instead of doing so, we began with our Declaration of Rights. We adopted that, went home, and the next day, December the 18th, came back and adopted our state constitution, recognizing that principle stated in our Declaration of Independence, that government is there to serve the people. Our rights come from God, we the people, and government there is to protect and defend those fundamental rights. Professor Orth, would you get us started, please?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice. I think, despite the blinding light, that I see a number of my former students here, and I wanted to I'm sorry, am I talking too loud?
Let me interrupt just a second, because I was reminded by my chief of staff. Now, I forgot to tell y'all what these are about. Okay, these are index cards on your table. At the end of our formal presentation in about 45 minutes, you have an opportunity to submit questions. As you have a question, please write it down. If you'll hold it up, we have students who are assisting us, and we'll come and pick those up. Thank you. Sorry, Professor Orr.
Well, anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to see those of you that I have seen in the classroom, and many that I had not met before. And so thank you very much for the invitation. My assignment is the deep background, you might say, and I really do take that assignment seriously. I want to speak about three different aspects of the question concerning the state constitution. Actually, I want to talk about the constitution properly so-called, the Declaration of Rights, and then at the end, a brief word or two about the relationship between the state and the federal constitution. So, going back to the beginning, it might surprise you when I said that I want to talk about the Constitution separately from the Declaration of Rights. We know it now, of course, as Article 1 of the current North Carolina Constitution. But I want to go back, as Chief Justice Newby has already suggested, back to 1776. Indeed, I want to go back even a lot farther and ask the basic question, what is a constitution? What is it for? And we have a nice definition from the Greek philosopher Aristotle, which is that a constitution is the arrangement of offices in a state, particularly the highest. That's kind of a surprising definition because most of us, and I know most citizens, think of the Constitution primarily concerning rights and not offices. But of course, there have to be offices. That's the foundational structure of the political institution. Indeed, every political organization has a constitution, written or implied. So, starting with that, I want to just connect it briefly to the historical experience of North Carolina. And I think the best way to do that is just to read a couple sentences that Justice Samuel Ashe wrote in 1786. This was in the preliminary movements for the case of Bayard v. Singleton, which actually established judicial review in North Carolina. But he starts off by saying, at the time of our separation from Great Britain, we were thrown into a similar situation with a set of people shipwrecked and cast on a marooned island. I think he's thinking like Robinson Crusoe. Here they all are. And he says, without laws, without magistrates, without government or any legal authority. In other words, the Declaration of Independence had severed the source of authority, which had been the crown. Power had flowed down from the crown. And what he realized, and he had been an officer himself in the Revolutionary War, what he realized is after the break with the British Empire, the former offices in the colonies really had no authority. You had to reconstitute, that's the Constitution, you had to reconstitute the society. And then he goes on to mention that North Carolina did this at a provincial congress in Halifax, and it created the Constitution and the Declaration of Rights. But I mentioned to the Chief Justice earlier that a couple days ago I asked a student print out a copy of the North Carolina Constitution of 1776. I just want to make sure I have it in my folder when I come to talk. And when I looked at it this morning, I realized that it doesn't include the Declaration of Rights. What he had done is just pulled a book. He actually used a book rather than online and photocopied the Constitution of North Carolina of 1776. And it's all about the arrangement of offices and elections and all of that. And it's interesting that the two documents which were adopted at Halifax were the Constitution, but the day before the Declaration of Rights. And the Constitution itself, in Section 44, incorporates the Declaration of Rights by reference. So it is made into one instrument after the Constitution was adopted on December the 18th. Includes the Declaration of Rights. We don't often think about the importance of the institutional structure and the Constitution, properly so-called, you might say, because the focus so much has always been on the other part, the Declaration of Rights. And so I want to say a few words about that. It's not like the Declaration of Independence, which was an indictment of King George III, bill of particulars about what he had done wrong. The Declaration of Rights states what the colonists in North Carolina wanted from their government after the revolution. And indeed, it's a rather peculiar mix of things, and I want to talk very briefly about that. I encourage you all to read it, or at least read its current iteration, which is basically 85% from 1776, in Article 1 of the North Carolina Constitution of 1971. Some of the provisions are really, I won't say precatory, but they're really hortatory. They're calling on principles which need to be implemented in the Constitution properly, so-called. For instance, the simplest example, elections should be frequent. Well, how frequent? Initially, it was thought they should be every year. Over time, in various amendments and iterations of the Constitution, terms lengthen, but that provision that they should be frequent remains unchanged. And I think the spirit of it is frequent enough. It can't be too long, but maybe every year is too short. So there are those sorts of provisions in the Declaration of Rights. But then there are other provisions which are quite detailed, and they really mostly concern, not solely, but mostly concern criminal procedure. Right the way through from search and seizure and arrest through trial and confrontation of witnesses and adversary proceeding through to punishment and bail, it's all there. So there's a code of criminal procedure in the Declaration of Rights. It, of course, has to be implemented later on in the Constitution and by statutes and by institutions. But I think that one of the reasons it's there is that that's where the rub came between colonial North Carolinians and the imperial officials, the empire officers, particularly the judges. And one of the grievances of the colonists was that colonial judges did not have security of tenure. They served at will. And this was particularly annoying because in 1714, English judges at home in England got lifetime tenure, removal only for cause after proper procedure. And so there was this sense that what we want to do in North Carolina is get everything that we're entitled to as Englishmen. Indeed, one of the overlooked resolutions of the Continental Congress prior to, it was in 1775, was to claim for the Americans the rights of life, liberty, property, and the common law of England. And that's what I wanted to transition to here, because I wanted to stress that the colonists, when asked if they had a constitution, would have said, yes, it's the Royal Charter. That's the arrangement of offices. Look there to see how we're supposed to run this society. If they were asked where their civil rights come from, they would have said, well, the common law. But the problem was that they felt increasingly that the common law was not being respected by the royal authorities. And so they wanted to make it concrete, and they wanted to get it in writing. They didn't want to just have this unwritten constitution of the common law. They wanted to have a written constitution. And we can't forget that written constitutions were new when the Americans wrote their constitutions. And I say constitutions because it's in the plural, that is states and then the federal constitution. Much of what went into the Declaration of Rights would have been common law rights before. I need to preach for one second here. One of the things that I occasionally find students say or the general public say, I've even had people who should know better say, we get our rights from the Constitution. That's false. If we got our rights from the Constitution, we could lose our rights if the people, God forbid, amended the Declaration of Rights out of the Constitution. We would still have the rights. They're not conferred on us by the Constitution. We have the rights. What the Constitution does, of course, is put it in writing and provide a mechanism for the recognition and enforcement of those rights. I've already mentioned that the original 1776 Constitution incorporated by reference the Declaration of Rights. A very, very quick rundown before I move to the final comment about the relationship between the state and federal constitutions. The North Carolina Constitution was written by very intelligent, very well-educated people with thorough knowledge of Roman history, the Republic, and of English history, particularly the struggle against the absolutist monarchs. But they were not absolutely able to predict everything. And one of the things that they omitted from the state constitution of 1776 was any amendment procedure. Probably in haste and writing down what they thought were the most important things, they didn't contemplate what do we do if we need to change this. Finally, in 1835, in a special constitutional convention, an extraordinary constitutional convention called just by a referendum, an amendment, many amendments, rebalancing the power of the state were adopted in 1835, including an amendment procedure to be used going forward. Of course, the rupture of the Civil War meant that a new constitution would be required. And in 1868, a new constitution was adopted. And it's remarkable how much of it survived right into the 20th and 21st century. In the 1970s, a constitutional commission proposed sort of clean up the text, but basically the 1971 constitution that we operate under is really the Declaration of Rights from 1776, loosely, lightly edited, the Constitution of 1968, brought up to date to the late 20th century. Now, I want to say a final word about the relationship between constitutions. And again, it's something that I like to stress to my class. We really should talk about constitutions in the plural. I've said that already once, but there's a tendency for people to think, well, there's only one. And one of the ways I get at that is I ask students, well, if we're going to have a Declaration of Rights or a Bill of Rights, where should it be? And I hate to tell you this, but they say at the end. And why is that? Well, that's where the Federal Bill of Rights is. And I said, you know, it was an afterthought. They didn't think they needed it at the end. That's why they put it there afterwards. The North Carolinians got it straight. That is, it comes first. That's where we start. Right? Now, of course, a dozen years after the North Carolina Constitution of 1776, we get a federal constitution, which includes the Supremacy Clause. All the laws, the Constitution, laws adopted pursuant to the Constitution and treaties made or which shall be made are the supreme law of the land, and judges, state judges, and federal judges, state judges, are bound by those rules. Right? Anything in the laws or constitutions of any state, to the contrary, notwithstanding. So we're under a supreme rule insofar as it is part of the sovereign power of the federal government. But a lot's left for the states. And that's the final point that I wanted to make here. One of the disturbing tendencies of the last 40 or 50 years is the assimilation of provisions of the state constitution as if they are the same as the federal constitution. And sometimes the wording is totally different. I would recommend to you an article published in the Elon Law Review, just a recent issue, by Judge Dietz, who points out the extent to which even very specific provisions of the state constitution are being treated as if they are to be interpreted the same way as more or less analogous provisions of the state constitution, which means everything gets watered down to a rational basis. And there really is quite a rich tradition which could be explored. I had pointed this out once before in a different context. North Carolina constitutional law was developing, and civil rights was developing, haltingly, slowly, but developing based on the state constitution. And then the incorporation doctrine, incorporating the Bill of Rights into the 14th Amendment and thereby applying it all to the states, really brought a grinding halt to the development of state provisions because it's all done at the federal level. Thank you. I've just got the signal that I need to stop so everybody else can talk. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Orr. Mr. Tripp.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good afternoon, everyone. Nice to be here with you today and to share some thoughts on the issues that Chief Justice Newby has spoken about and what we just heard from the professor on. My input here stems from the fact that I was the general counsel to the North Carolina Senate at the time that one of the first modern era, I won't say first, excuse me, there's my friends or generation earlier litigated this question, but one of the 21st century issues of the allocation of power between the branches in North Carolina state government arose, and that was something called the Kolash case. And you might also know it as State v. Berger. Is very interesting for a number of reasons, not the least of which is it arose because a coal ash pond in Rockingham County, North Carolina, shattered and flooded into the Dan River, which caused everyone in the state to realize around Groundhog Day in February 2014 that we had coal ash ponds situated all across the state of North Carolina. That was the most effective, most cost-efficient means to store coal ash, which is a byproduct from power generation at these power plants across the state. But when the dam broke on the Dan River, we all quickly realized, the North Carolina Senate and the House realized that there were ponds all over, and as did the McCrory administration, and something needed to be done about them. So as a matter of policy and policy decision making, the legislature decided to create a structure where these ponds would be classified based on the risk tolerance or the risk of them failing in the way that the Dan River pond had failed. And those classifications were to be decided not by DEQ, which I think was the name of the agency at the time, but instead by an independent commission created called the Coal Ash Commission. There were two other commissions in that conversation, but we'll just focus on the Coal Ash Commission for a second. But that policy choice made by the legislature with objection and policy input from the administration produced the lawsuit that we'll talk a moment about, and that lawsuit begat a series of lawsuits wrestling with the very iterative process that the professor talked about. So by January of 2016, an opinion was issued by our Supreme Court by some titans of the bar who authored both the majority and the dissenting opinions, who both happen to be in the room right now. So I'll be careful trying to speak for others and what the old mind-reading trick of opinions. Mr. Chief Justice, nice to see you. But what you saw in the coal ash decision was trying to wrestle, as Professor Orth talked about, with this wonderful aspirational language in Article 1 of our state constitution, competing against the structural components of later parts of the Constitution. And how do you reconcile the separation of powers clause in Article 1 with the nuts and bolts of later parts in the Constitution of how appointments are made by whether it's the governor or the legislature, and also how the laws are faithfully executed, and also still how the General Assembly allocates power among various executive branch agencies. All three of those nuts and bolts provisions are located later in our state constitution, but still in Article 1, as Professor Orth mentioned, is listed this separation of powers provision. So the coal ash case was about how do you reconcile the two, the extent to which a provision in Article 1 can be used to interpret the remainder of the Constitution. And in that instance, the court held that the governor, as the chief executive officer of the state of North Carolina, has certain powers that required that he be allowed to control a majority. And I don't want to dumb it down too much, Mr. Chief Justice, so forgive me. But the governor be allowed to assert his executive power over executive decisions in North Carolina. And that being the first instance of wrestling with that question opened the door to a series of challenges in the ensuing years about the structuring of government under the state constitution, which, as Professor Orth alluded to, hadn't really been done since the early part of the 20th century. I think the challenge with those lawsuits, both the coal ash case and the ensuing lawsuits, is you introduce a great deal of discretion, and I don't mean that pejoratively to anyone, but both lawyers who are pleading those cases and thinking about the claims you might marshal, and then also the jurists who have to decide those questions, have to wrestle with language that some may not even have known existed, reading parts, as Professor Orth alluded to, reading parts of the first part of our Constitution for maybe the first time, and then going back in time to read interpretations from the first part of the 20th century and after the Civil War. There's some wonderful history in our jurisprudence about the way that the state constitution evolved over the years. But what you found in that iterative process from the coal ash decision came down in 2016, so 6 years ago. In the last 6 years, what you see is a great deal of questions being put to the judiciary where they, in my opinion, it's often a tough nut to crack. As a jurist, not being a jurist, I would look at it and say, it's easy for lawyers to articulate arguments. We're all creative lawyers, or at least try to be. But it's the jurists who have to decide where to draw the line on policy choices made by the political branches. And so if I had a word of caution as we go forward in this iterative process, I would suggest that deference to the political processes, deference to the political questions presented when at least two branches disagree over how a decision ought to be made or how a governmental agency ought to be structured, that's probably the most acute scenario where you want to show that deference, because the alternative, where a jurist has to decide between the political branches, is going to be an inelegant solution in the sense that the jurist has to weigh factors that may be beyond the case file. It may be all sorts of policy seascape that needs to be addressed by the political branches in deciding that question to produce whatever it is that is sitting before the jurist in making the decision. And I think if you read the jurisprudence from that day forward, you see judges who had to wrestle with really hard questions about the allocation of power among the political branches using sparing text in some instances. So in my sense of things, you know, we lawyers make a living making some level of reasonable prediction to our clients as to what might happen. In my sense of things, the iterative process the professor alluded to counsels for restraint and deference to the political branches on these close questions where you have, using a phrase, text on both sides of the question, or else we're asking our judges to make very hard calls with little textual guidance to hang on to. And I'm interested to hear from Ryan, because Ryan, what I was doing 10 years ago now, Ryan is having to do now as we litigate these questions of separations of powers.
Thank you, Mr. Park.
Well, yeah, thank you for having me. First off, it is a real honor to be sharing the stage with our state's Chief Justice and with Professor Orth and the rest of the panel. I feel like I'm your student because this book really is kind of the foundational text for when you're trying to learn about the state constitution, and we use it in the classroom, and we also pull it out every single time there is a new novel constitutional claim that is filed against the state, which happens a lot. And you know, people, when their rights are violated, many times they choose to, or they believe that they've been violated, they choose to file a lawsuit against the state, and we're seeing more and more often that these claims are coming under the state constitution instead of the federal constitution or other sources of law. So we really are in a golden age of state constitutional law, and I think that is both incredibly exciting and incredibly daunting. I was thinking about, I think this is apocryphal, but you know, the ancient Chinese curse, you know, may you live in interesting times. And we really do live in quite interesting times in terms of state constitutional law. So I thought maybe I could say a little bit about why I think that's happening, and then maybe just give some insights into how you proceed when you're facing a novel constitutional claim. I guess first I'd also just like to bracket, I see clients and opposing counsel in the room, and when you are the state, you know, everyone likes to see you. I often am, you know, within a single day even, am working on a brief on behalf of the governor opposing a claim brought against him by the NAACP or the ACLU. And then I turn to the other Word document and I am working on a brief on behalf of the legislative leaders opposing a claim brought against us by the Institute for Justice or you know, some other group. And in every different permutation imaginable we have seen when you're working for the state. So why is this happening? Well, I think there's a couple clear reasons. I would really echo Professor Orr's kind of imploration just to read the Declaration of Rights and the rest of the Constitution. I mean, it'll take you 10 minutes, about the time that I've been given to speak here. And you'll find that there's all sorts of things that are not in the federal Constitution, not in other areas of law. For example, in the first section of the Declaration of Rights, we have the right to the fruits of our own labors. And what does that mean? If you, as I was before I came and worked for the state, mainly focusing on the federal Constitution, it was a very interesting, surprising thing to have to try to grapple with and learn about. So it's just in the text of the Constitution itself. Second, you know, I think that when the federal Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, withdraws from a particular area of law, you naturally see that pressure starting to bubble up in the state courts as well. I mean, there's many contemporary examples of that, but I think even the quintessential state constitutional disputes, like the long-running Leandra litigation, that only happened across the country in many state courts after the U.S. Supreme Court vacated the field and said, you know, there is no federal right to education, you know, in Rodriguez, and there is no, you know, heightened scrutiny for wealth disparities under the Equal Protection Clause. And so after that happened, the same people who were bringing those lawsuits started bringing them in state courts, including in our state courts. And I think the third thing is, as you know, I think Andrew alluded to, when you live in contentious times, then you see contentious lawsuits and you see interesting constitutional litigation bubbling up. I tell my class it's no surprise that the last previous golden age of state constitutional law was kind of in the mid-80s to the early 90s when you had divided government in the state. And so there's all sorts of interesting separation of powers and other rights claims being made that were completely novel. Yeah, and the last thing I'd say is one thing that I think is salutary about our Constitution is it's a lot easier to amend than the U.S. Constitution. And so you see new laws, new constitutional provisions being put into the document. So just this week, we got, I think it was Tuesday, the first appellate decision in North Carolina interpreting the right to hunt and fish. You know, there's a right to hunt and fish in our Constitution. Well, what does that mean? And we have to wait for the courts to tell us and advocates to try to figure it out. And they are just starting to do that. That was a lawsuit brought against the state as well. So I think, you know, those are some of the factors at play. You know, in terms of being a practitioner, and I think this might touch on some of the issues that Andrew mentioned. Well, what do you do when you get these claims? I mean, this is literally my job. Sometimes on a Friday night, I get a complaint forwarded to me, and they say, well, there's this new lawsuit saying that you're violating the right to hunt and fish because of certain, you're not regulating certain fishing practices that, you know, that reduce fish stock. And I am supposed to be able to have an intelligent conversation with people about what that means, whether this is a claim that has teeth. Well, so first you pick up this book, and you try to find something, and unfortunately for that lawsuit, you didn't. you have to do an update. But, you know, second, you, of course, start with the text, and Justice Kagan famously said in a kind of a ceremony honoring Justice Scalia that we're all textualists now, and we are all textualists now. You always start with the text. But sometimes, like this case, you just don't know. I don't think the text doesn't tell you, you know, what are the standards for the right to hunt and fish, and you know, does this regulation or non-regulation violate it? And so I think what's really exciting is that then you get into the history. So like we're all textualists now, we're all originalists now. And I think people have various differing views on how far the history gets you. You know, is it definitive? Is it just informative? Is it one of many things that you consider, or is it everything? But especially when there's an open field and there's not a wide body of precedent, all you have is the history. And it's fun. I mean, I liked being a student. I like to still be a student. And so you go to the General Assembly. You try to see what was behind this motivation. What was motivating, you know, this new constitutional provision? Or often, you know, what does all elections shall be free mean? I don't know if I'm quoting that correctly, but you know, what does it mean to have a free election? And in that case, you go to the stacks in the libraries, and you're kind of thumbing through old documents, even primary sources, often as a lawyer trying to figure out what this means. And I think that it just makes state constitutional practice really interesting because you get to dive through the history books and try to learn everything you can about what was going on at the time, what these words meant to the people at the time, and you know, what was the evil out there that they were trying to address with a particular constitutional provision. And so that is kind of my job. And I guess to try to create a dialogue here, I mean, you know, a lot of that presupposes that these are you know, justiciable questions for the courts to decide. And that is also something that ideally the history can offer some insight into. You know, for example, you know, did the people of North Carolina in 2018 imagine that this would be that the right to hunt and fish would be a privately enforceable action? Is this something that was vested in our environmental agencies, our General Assembly, to try to determine, or was it a question for the courts? So I think that too is an open question they have to try to research and find the answer to.
Thank you so much. Before we hear from Chief Justice Markham, just a reminder, you've got your index cards. If you have any questions, please go ahead and jot those down and hold them up, and they'll be picked up. Chief Justice Markham.
Well, I respectfully take strong issue with Professor Orth. He said that he finds the blinding lights that we're facing, which we are, to be very difficult. Actually, I appreciate them very much because it spares me from seeing your grimaces and your potential displays of puzzlement. So thank you for the blinding lights, everyone. I would also notice this is not my first time in North Carolina. I graduated from Duke University about 52 or 53 years ago. And I assume very few of us crossed paths at the time when I was back there. But I would say that things have changed. My recollection is, if I had any recollection of Coach K, it was that he was still being hazed at West Point at the time. And even more remarkably, the boys and the girls were separated on campuses. That is how long ago it was. Let me briefly offer several observations, if I can, concerning the revitalization of state constitutionalism. This has been given increasing and deserved attention by the Federalist Society over the past year. And to me, it's of great credit to the Federalist Society and to organizations around North Carolina that their inaugural state conference would be focused upon this, that there's a different debate in America today than there was when I was at Duke is, in my view, largely attributable to the Federalist Society. They've transformed the debate in the United States. Whereas once the great debate over jurisprudence was whether or not we were going to confirm President Nixon's law and order or strict constructionist judges, the nature of our jurisprudential discussion has changed enormously. And for the better, in my opinion. And it's been the Federalist Society that's done much of that transformation. And it's alumni of the Federalist Society in the judiciary and elsewhere, in academia and elsewhere, in the past 50 years, who have contributed astonishingly to that debate. And I expect that in the next 50 years, people in this room and who participate today in the Federalist Society will be responsible for future transformations that we see. Observation number one, if I might. Why should state constitutionalism be encouraged? Of course, for the same reason that the values of federalism generally should be encouraged, because North Carolina judicial and constitutional perspectives and attitudes may differ from those of New York and California. Because our 50 states are increasingly polarized into red and blue and purple colors, and it may be best that each be allowed some greater flexibility to sort out these differences rather than having to adhere to a one-size-fits-all public policy. Because we've learned from our founders that there's something important about government that was closest to the people. Because we've drawn from our historical experiences that there's something valuable about states being allowed to engage in experimentation in diverse public policies. And because our federal constitutional architecture itself is built upon the foundations of federalism, allocating and dispersing power between our national and local governments in a great many ways. And also because our state constitutions have each been ratified by we the people of North Carolina or Michigan, and thus they deserve the fullest respect and regard of those who serve at the favor of these people on our judiciary. And also because those who look carefully at the growth and development of our extraordinary country will recognize that during our first century and a half, when our 30 or 40 or 50 constitutions mattered greatly in the affairs of our nation, far more than they do today, these charters served very well to govern and unite a great and dispersed and accomplished people. Observation number two, how should state courts then give meaning to their own constitutions? Of course, by looking first to the language of these constitutions to assess what the judicial authority is all about. And what typically will be found will be reference to the judicial power to be exercised within a system defined by the separation of powers and by institutions of representative self-government. And for these reasons, of course, we give meaning to our state constitutions by assessing their words and language to discern their most reasonable meaning to the people in whose name these charters were ratified. If it's the rule of law that we're seeking and the rule of judges that we're seeking to avoid, we must interpret our state constitutions, as with all other positive sources of the law, in accord with precepts of originalism, interpretivism, and respect for representative institutions. What was meant, in other words, to be communicated by their language to later generations, or what the preamble to the federal constitution speaks about as their posterity. Not because any of these are the approaches of Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas or even of the Federalist Society, but because these are the only approaches that are faithful to the meaning of the law, that are in accord with first principles of logic and reason and neutrality and legitimacy, what in other words is meant when we speak about a process of interpretation. Observation number three, I'm not oblivious, and in this I'm certainly in accord with my colleagues, that state constitutions may differ from our federal constitution in various significant ways. For example, in Michigan, the separation of powers principle is made explicit, and advisory judicial opinions are allowed in limited circumstances. Moreover, state constitutions tend generally to be more detailed than the federal constitution, easier to amend, and accompanied by more or less in the way of legislative history. Yet none of these factors, I respectfully believe, warrant departure from originalist and textualist premises and interpretations. Those which respect the language of the law, conform to the architecture of institutions that have been established by that constitutional law and that satisfy the judicial oath of office. Observation number four. And how then should state constitutions not be given meaning as we seek to elevate their place within our federalist structure? Most of all, they should not be given meaning in ways that obscure their independent and sovereign stature, I believe. Thus, for example, I would avoid so-called lockstep provisions in which state courts effectively cede to federal courts the custodianship of similar provisions of their own constitutions. It is one thing to be bound or persuaded by federal interpretations, another to be inflexibly bound at the hip. For as I understand the Federalist Society project, it is not merely to elevate state constitutions, but in so doing to elevate American constitutionalism as well. It is not to expand the realm in which questionable exercises of the judicial power govern, but to expand the realm of what should endure and preserve, be preserved in terms of responsible interpretations of the Constitution. And those are the responsibilities of state jurists who are the arbiters of these distinctions when the meaning of their own constitutions are at issue. Observation number five, but even more consequential than the avoidance of lockstep provisions, I would very rigorously avoid the interpretations of state constitutions that rubber stamp what the late Professor David Curry of the University of Chicago Law School once characterized as the liberal or the progressive search for the constitutional holy grail, which he defined as a constitutional provision that allows judges to strike down all laws they dislike and to uphold all laws that they do like. In short, the pursuit of broad, vague, and open-ended constitutional provisions, each largely removed from historical context, which serve the personal agendas of non-federalist judges seeking to impose upon the people, absent debate, public policies, again, that they have no obligation to debate and to explain to the people. What are these holy grail provisions? Well, there's a number of them. There's, of course, the right of privacy that we've learned so much in the context of Roe versus Wade. There are arbitrarily determined protected categories that apply under the Equal Protection Clause. There's fundamental rights conceptions of the 14th Amendment. There's, of course, substantive due process. There's rational basis analysis. And I believe soon to be coming to a courtroom near you, there will be the Privileges and Immunities Clause, the Ninth Amendment, proportionality of criminal sentencing, and the utterly standardless decision-making in such realms as redistricting and gerrymandering. These holy grail provisions have in common interpretations of the Constitution that rely heavily upon the conscience and discretion of the judge, and only slightly upon the language and the intentions of the framers, upon an individual sense of justice rather than justice under law, upon the legislative ought to be the law power rather than upon the judicial is the law power, all at odds, in other words, with the observation of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, that the highest example of judicial duty is the subordination of personal will and private views to the law. Observation number seven. Such holy grail constitutionalism is barely constitutionalism at all, in my judgment, and should not be extended to our state constitutions. Already in Michigan, such holy grail thinking on the part of the federal judiciary has resulted in the federal preemption of our state constitutions in dozens of critical areas in recent years by the federalization of a broad range of disputes that once would have been decided by state courts under our local constitution. For example, in recent years, taking unto the federal courts such matters as electoral recounts, criminal appeals, sentencing guidelines, straight ticket voting, electoral integrity, sex offender registration, advertising of local adult businesses, juvenile sentencing, state prisoner rights, employee pensions, welfare entitlements, emergency municipal managers, affirmative action, legislative procedures, state redistricting, criminal procedure, and of course, laws defining marriage, to name just a few. Observation number 8. As a result, our state constitution, dating back to 1835, has increasingly become an afterthought for the bench and bar, infrequently asserted by litigants and only sporadically studied by the bench and the bar. We have no such great book as what you have here. If not moribund, our state constitution is hardly bristling with life, and if not altogether defunct, it nonetheless could be made considerably more funked. But our court has not done more to reinvigorate our Constitution because more simply has not been allowed. There are too many provisions of that Constitution that have either been rendered effectively dormant by principles of incorporation or simply supplanted by a federal constitution vastly broadened by Holy Grail principles and provisions. Where once state constitutions mattered greatly, the legacy of these and other innovations is that today they matter increasingly little. Finally, my last observation. And when liberals speak of state constitutionalism, as they are increasingly doing because they feel victimized by decisions like Dobbs and Heller, what they have in mind is an expansion of Holy Grail thinking to state constitutions. That's how they would approach the expansion of the role of state constitutions. In Michigan, for example, in just the past couple months, our governors urged that both the right of privacy and the right of abortion under Roe and Casey, made up in those cases, be extended and made up in the state constitution. And a sentence of life without parole has been deemed as disproportionate and therefore unconstitutional under the Michigan Constitution, a theory rejected even by the U.S. Supreme Court in the context of the Eighth Amendment. To be fair, I have to say there are also conservative state courts that have expanded upon Holy Grail concepts such as substantive due process to forbid the licensure of various occupations around the country. Much as I'm committed to free enterprise and free markets, we don't need to expand the realm of public policy that's decided exclusively by lawyers in black robes and under provisions that have no under provisions that bear no relationship to their original purposes or meaning. In short, again, I wish to enhance the role of the state constitutions by expanding their proper realm. And equally, I wish not to enhance the role of state judges by expanding their improper realm. It is the role of state constitutions that must be elevated, not the discretion of state judges. If the legacy of the Federalist Society, which is already an enormously positive legacy, but if their future legacy is that our judges can imagine as many creative and innovative constitutional theories as the other guys and wield as much judicial power belonging to other institutions just as the other guys do, then much will be lost for we, the people of North Carolina and Michigan, will have been deprived simply of an even greater amount of authority that belongs to the province of representative self-government, what I believe remains arguably the greatest legacy of both our federal and state constitutions. Sorry for going on so long, but thank you for your patience, and thank you to the Federalist Society, all the chapters of North Carolina, for your efforts to reinvigorate state constitutionalism. You couldn't have a better cause. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice Markham. We'll say that about half the room will disagree with your observation that by going to Duke, you were in North Carolina.
I have some familiarity with that concept, too.
I have been famously quoted as saying, I've spent my whole life in North Carolina except for the 4 years I went to Duke. So, I want to apologize that we will not be able to ask all the questions that were written, and for reasons that could be evident if one of the questions appears to be case-related to cases that are currently pending, I'm afraid I won't be able to pose those questions. This is a general question. It relates somewhat to everybody's observations. Co-equal branches, end quote. It is often said that the three branches of government established by the NC Constitution are co-equal. Yet the legislature, the legislative branch, appears to have plenary power, appears to have been given significantly more power than the other two branches. First, why is this the case? And secondly, is there anything in particular in North Carolina history that may have led to that design? And please, any of you, as you want to jump in on it, on these questions, well, please do so.
I'll just make first a personal comment. I don't know what the prefix co adds to equal. It reminds me of the redundancy of exactly the same. I mean, it seems to me it's equal. All right. Now, that's a word that's not in the Declaration of Rights. Declaration of Rights talks about separate and distinct. Getting on to the broader question, I think it's certainly true that the drafters of the Constitution in 1776 located most of the power in the General Assembly. And indeed, the fact that North Carolina would not give the governor veto power until very late, the last state to do so, is indicative of the fact that the experience with the executive during the colonial period, the royal governors, had been very bad. And so the state constitution obviously assigns the people's sovereign authority to legislate to the General Assembly, subject to certain specific limits. And then the judiciary is to enforce, and the executive is to see that the laws are enforced, and the judiciary to resolve any disputes. So that's the way I would answer that question, but I think others should have a chance to address it too.
Yes, please.
I would suggest that, you know, in my study that I talked about the coal ash case way back, you realize how much North Carolinians at the time distrusted the colonial governor. And you see it first in the way that the executive branch is bifurcated among the Council of State and the idea of they really were raging against consolidated executive power. Now, that iterated over the years, but it's hard for me, I think aspirationally, you know, separate co-equal branch might sound good, but I think you have to be governed by the text of the document organizing our government. So again, you have that, to Professor Orth's point, the word equal, co-equal is not in the text. But what there are ample instances of allocation of power across the various branches, both discrete and more general powers. And you also see that the legislature serves for 2 years. I know there are former legislators in the room, and you know how nice might it have been, not having served in the legislature, how nice might it have been to have served for 4 years every now and then, to avoid campaign cycles and being that close to the people. I know that the federal model is different between the House and the Senate, but in North Carolina, the power to tax, the power to destroy, and those who have the power to tax serve for 2 years and have to answer to the people. So I think our Constitution doesn't contemplate equal separate branches. They're different branches with different roles, but I think they were intentional about allocation of power.
So this is somewhat non-responsive, but I think it's helpful context, which is, you know, one of the branches is itself divided. I work for a Council of State member who was independently elected, and there are many of them. So when you're talking about the executive branch, even that does not mean entirely the governor. And there are, in a state like ours, there are a whole wide variety of views and perspectives and interests that are at stake, even within the executive branch. And so that's something that I navigate on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I don't know how much I can comment specifically on the North Carolina Constitution. I apologize for that. But I'm pretty sure that if someone was to review the Federalist Papers and other revolutionary documents, almost certainly the most powerful, the most equal of the branches would have been the legislative branch. And I'm pretty sure they didn't use the term that three branches were co-equal. Nonetheless, the characterization of co-equal branches does remind us, usefully, that we have a system of separated powers, and we have three branches that exercise those powers and exercise checks and balances upon the other branches. I haven't assigned a number to each of the powers and each of the checks and balances that exist within our Constitution, state or federal, to calculate how they compare, but I would say this with some certainty, that however these calculations would come out and whatever equality they would show or not show, they would show that since 1789, the judiciary has had a power number that's far increased compared to the other two branches of government. And if you want what to me is the best illustration of that, you might want to take a look, if you're interested, in the Boumediene case that was decided a number of years ago by the Supreme Court, in which the whole question of deciding who was an enemy combatant abroad, particularly in the Middle East at that time, who was an enemy combatant, did no longer belonged to the executive branch as it had always and historically belonged, but now was being transferred as a result of Boumediene to the federal district courts. And Justice Kennedy, I think in his majority opinion in that case, said there's nothing that vindicates the Congress and the executive branch better than the fact that we now have federal courts involved in the process. I'm not sure I see it exactly the same way.
Public trust and confidence. How can we combat the notion that judges, state court judges, particularly as they apply state constitutional law, are not simply super legislators in black robes?
Well, I think I've offered my 2 cents worth of that issue. I do think that's increasingly what they become, particularly under these Holy Grail provisions where there's basically no standards by which they're obligated to give meaning to the law. And to me, the law, interpretation of the law, is all about standards. And these Holy Grail provisions essentially have in common that they are enhancing federal judicial power generally, but federal judicial power in particular, and they're doing so subject to no particular standards. So I think that when you have that combination or that concatenation, you have a system in which there is more public policy decision-making that's being made by the institution that was supposed to be the least dangerous institution, which is premised upon the idea that it was the least equal institution. And we're seeing, I think, continued movement in exactly the opposite direction, whereas almost every public policy problem at some point has to be opined on and has to be resolved by that one branch of government that's comprised exclusively of lawyers. And where did this proposition come to be understood that lawyers have a better sense of how to apportion power than do accountants or widget manufacturers, or they have a better sense of justice than do dentists or hardware salesmen? I mean, why we have lawyers exclusively on the court is that they're presumably trained to read the law and to give meaning to difficult provisions of the law, and that's what they ought to limit themselves to doing when they're blessed with the opportunity to serve on a judicial body of the United States or a state.
Anybody else want to weigh in?
Well, I'll just add a comment. Despite my age and gray hair, I still cling to the notion that law and politics are different. It's very troubling me always to see in the press a Republican justice did this, a Democratic justice did that, and the assumption that all we need to do is look at party labels, and we'll know what the result on questions that might have a political angle to them. Further, I think that the court could, not so much our court, but it's particularly true of the United States Supreme Court, when it writes a 90-page opinion, which, and some of them I've read turn out to be highly repetitive, with concurrences and partial concurrences and dissents, it's not something that even a trained lawyer finds very easy to read. And I think back to the magisterial opinions of John Marshall, who actually wanted them to be published in the newspaper and that people could read them and understand them, assuming only a fairly general knowledge of the history and Constitution. You go back and look at those opinions, and they're really luminous, and compare it to some of the recent decisions. And again, I've had more than one person talk to me about cases recently decided in various courts. Well, what does it mean? I mean, and you go back and you do try to figure out, if I was the trial judge, what in the world would I be expected to do now that it's been remanded under these instructions? Again, the court could speak more directly to the people, I think, and write opinions which are readable and informative and instructive. That's my, again, suggestion.
Y'all want to
not directed at anyone in particular.
Either of y'all want to weigh in?
I would say that, if you've ever awaited a decision from a jurist and you thought you had it pegged based on, as the professor alluded to, who appointed that jurist or what letter might appear next to his or her name, and you got that decision and went the other way, that'll restore your faith in the rule of law. So that's certainly been my experience.
I mean, I'll just say, I believe very strongly in role fidelity, and as practicing litigator, again, with a lot of different clients, I think it's just important for everyone within the system to understand what your role is in that system, and, so I think is the best I can give as an answer to that question.
Thank y'all. The next question is, the federal constitution primarily protects negative rights. Many states, including North Carolina, protect positive rights. How should courts approach enforcements of these rights differently, if they should? The example was given was the right to the privilege of an education. There are plenty of others in our state constitution, like hunting and fishing.
I don't know, so I don't want to say anything.
Well, I think it's a great question. I mean, if there's any legacy of our Constitution, anything distinctive about our Constitution, I think there's a lot that's distinctive about our Constitution, not to mention, not least of which, is that it's given rise to one of the greatest countries in the history of the world in terms of the extent of freedom that we enjoy, the sense of prosperity, the stability, the charity, the compassion of our people, the achievement of our arts. So, you look at our Constitution, it's largely, of course, a negative rights Constitution. The state can't take away your right not to be subject to cruel and unusual punishment, or it can't deprive you of has to conduct reasonable searches and seizures. But I've always wondered why among the 190 or so constitutions, many of which have been adopted by the developing world over, just since the Second World War, almost none of them look to the American Constitution and say, what is distinctive about this? And maybe we ought to take just a second look at it. The United States Constitution and the few that resemble it, with its emphasis upon negative rights, or those that seek to define rights by what your fellow citizens owe you as opposed to what you're owed in terms of excessive actions by the government. So I've never could understand why there's so little concern about that, just generally among constitutional makers around the world.
I think the question of positive rights in the Constitution, for the jurist trying to vindicate those interests in our state constitution, I think if the system works well, you have the luxury of bidding against someone else's policy prescription. And that's probably the best path to go down to balance the modesty of the judicial role with the obligation to vindicate rights in the Constitution. I think you look at what the political branches have fashioned to determine if you believe that that measures up.
Mr. Park, you can have the last word.
I think this is incredibly a good question. It's very hard. I think my perspective is that it's incumbent upon courts to understand how the remedial process is going to play out when you're dealing with positive rights, because that's where everything becomes difficult. Enforcement of a negative right against a state official or a state agency is very straightforward. You can't do this. But then with positive rights, the easy part is declaring the right. The hard part is the remedy. And so when you're declaring the right, to try to understand how the remedy will play out, I think is my thought.
Thank you. My takeaway from the panel, other than that they're all brilliant and I'm grateful that they've taken time to present to us, was Mr. Park's comment about Justice Kagan saying we're all originalists, we're all textualists. That is certainly, as Chief Justice Markham commented, a great tribute to the Federalist Society and all the great work that they have and continue to do. And it's a great challenge for all of us, certainly as on the bench, to be better historians, to be better linguists, to take advantage of all the great tools that are developing across our nation to help us better understand the original intent of the precise words of the text. We have a 15-minute interlude before our next panel. I'm sure if you have a question, and many of you did, again, I apologize for not being able to get to all of them. You're welcome to talk to one of the panelist members before the next group begins. But let's give the panelists a round of thanks.